Premier Christian Newscast.
Last week was a momentous one in the long-running civil war over same-sex relationships in the Church of England. Just like in February, a session of the General Synod, the Church's elected parliament, was almost entirely focused on scrutinising the bishop's plans to offer services of blessing for gay couples in church. It has got increasingly complicated, with convoluted discussions of canon law and synodical procedure, theology and ethics. But at its heart, this is a window into a church that is deeply divided, almost 50-50, between liberals who affirm LGBT relationships and conservatives who cannot. And this is an important story about how the country's largest denomination is trying and trying and trying again to tease out a way of reconciling those two, perhaps irreconcilable, groups. I'm Tim Wyatt, and this is the Premier Christian Newscast. Today's episode is arriving early because the news seemed just too weighty to wait until Monday morning. I sat through every minute of the synod last week, and I'm going to try, with the help of guests from all sides, to explain what on earth just happened, why it matters, and what might be coming next. For more than the last decade, the Church of England has been agonising about same-sex relationships. It's easy to get lost into the weeds of what has been a torturous and at times tedious debate, but at its heart, it's actually relatively simple. A growing number of people within the Church, going all the way up to the bishops and archbishops, who are in theory running the show, now believe it is right to affirm gay couples in their relationships. Many want to go as far as introducing gay marriage on equal terms as straight marriage in church. But opposing them, there remains a sizable chunk of the church, largely but not exclusively evangelicals, who strongly disagree and want to hold on to the existing teaching that marriage and sex are only for heterosexual couples. These two factions have been at loggerheads for a long time. At the start of this year, after much discussion, the most senior bishops in the church produced a plan they hoped would move the church forward. They proposed to introduce prayers and services of blessing for gay couples, but to keep the traditional marriage doctrine unchanged. This was narrowly endorsed in a vote of the General Synod in February. We actually did two episodes of the newscast about this, so if you need a refresher, do pause this episode, go back to listen to those two from January and February this year. Now, last week, after months of lobbying, squabbling, secret meetings, leaks from those same secret meetings and much more besides, everyone trooped back to the synod for a second round. On the table this time was not the idea of gay blessings, but how on earth the bishops were going to implement February's vote.
So I'm just walking into Church House in Westminster, the headquarters of the Church of England and the venue for this latest meeting of the General Synod, where representatives from all 42 dioceses in the Church of England are once again gathering clergy, laypeople and bishops to argue it out over the ever contentious issue of gay blessings. Just a quick bit of background for those of you who haven't been following all the twists and turns of this increasingly complex process. We were last here in February this year when the bishops brought a draft set of liturgies and prayers known as the Prayers of Love and Faith, or PLF, which would for the first time basically create services and options for parishes in the Church of England which wanted to bless same-sex couples. There was a big contentious debate during February's synod meeting. It lasted Oh, it lasted, I think, about 8 hours over 2 days, and in the end, it voted to go ahead with the plan, although, crucially, there was also an amendment passed which said that these prayers of love and faith, when they are eventually unveiled, must not indicate any kind of departure from the Church's teaching on marriage, which remains officially that only one man and one woman can get married. So what's happened since, in the kind of 6 months since February? Well, we've had evangelicals, traditionalists, conservatives been lobbying furiously to try and stop the prayers of love and faith. We've had a few larger churches which have actually stopped paying their voluntary financial contributions to their diocese in protest, and some others have been exploring whether they could bring in more conservative Anglican bishops from overseas to replace their more liberal pro-gay blessing bishops, and others have actually even kind of issued these veiled legal threats. And we've also had a kind of to and fro between the bishops and these opponents of PLF. The bishops have started work on what is being called, or was originally called, pastoral reassurance, and is now being called pastoral provision. And this is basically some kind of plan to protect the consciences of traditionalists who oppose the PLF. And so while the PLF remain in draft form, they haven't actually been kind of officially introduced, the bishops have said that their intention is to commend them to the Church, and this means that they would be added to the kind of existing suite of optional voluntary prayers and services that vicars can choose to use if they want to, but no parish should be obliged to offer gay couples any blessings or prayers if they don't want to. However, there's been a kind of intense legal row. Conservatives have been arguing that actually the Church's constitution doesn't permit this. The rules state that bishops can only commend services which don't indicate a departure from Church doctrine in any essential matter. And in recent times, this kind of commending pathway has mostly been used for kind of one-off services covering non-controversial issues that don't already, you know, have a suite of prayers or liturgies because they're new circumstances, but they're not kind of partisan, contested theological issues. However, the conservative opponents of the PLF have strongly argued that if the Church is now for the first time blessing a gay couple who might be having sex and in a civil same-sex marriage, it was by default contradicting its doctrine on marriage and sex. And so they said the only safe legal route to bring in the PLF can't be by this commendation by the bishops, but by a full legislative process through synod, which is a much more complex and lengthy process. It takes at least a couple of years. You need to consult with all the 42 dioceses, and there are several rounds of debates at the synod, and at the very end the synod would need to vote in favour of the prayers by at least a two-thirds majority in each of its three houses of laity, clergy and bishops. Critically, this is the critical point, while the prayers were passed by a simple majority back in February, they didn't reach two-thirds support among either the clergy or the laity. So this is seen as a kind of, by the liberals, as an attempt to shut down debate by forcing the prayers to go through this process. It would require the two-thirds majority, which doesn't exist in the synod. So the bishops have been meeting with the various sides over the summer and trying to carve a way forward. But a final decision was released just before the synod met in October. In a kind of long paper, the House of Bishops explained that they actually would push ahead with commending the PLF so that any parish which would wanted to could bless gay couples, but they said that these could only be used within normal, regular church services. The kind of blessing of the gay couple couldn't be the only reason people are here, so that would have to take place on a regular Sunday service or something like that. And if you wanted to hold a special standalone service just to bless a gay couple, which is what a lot of people are looking for, because that might resemble something closer to a blessing after a civil marriage, for instance, that is not going to be commended. That is going to go through the full synodical legislative process, which will take at least until 2025, and it will require a two-thirds majority. So frankly, at this point, unless a lot of people change their mind, it's doubtful whether that will ever be approved. They also said that there are long-awaited rules on what the prayers mean for vicars are not yet ready, and so they haven't even been introduced to be discussed at this synod. Currently, this is again a massive flashpoint, currently priests in the Church of England are not allowed to marry same-sex partners in civil weddings outside of church, and they can only be in a civil partnership as long as they promised to be celibate. And liberal activists have been lobbying for many years to loosen these rules. And earlier, the bishops have said that they would actually bring forward these changed rules on clergy conduct alongside the prayers, but they've actually gone back on that and said, we're not finished, we're not ready, we haven't decided yet. So, what has really happened since February? To sum all of that up, the major headline really is that since the PLF proposals were first unveiled, it still remains the same. The bishops are going to, very imminently, we're expecting it in the next month or so, they're going to officially unveil, commend in the legal language, prayers that parishes can use to bless same-sex couples and their relationships for the very first time. This obviously falls a lot short of what a lot of the liberals want, which is to allow gay people to get married in church on equal status to straight couples, which the bishops have said they just don't see a way that they can bring that in. However, there have actually been some subtle but significant tweaks since that initial plan. Firstly, as I said, the stripping out of the kind of standalone services and requiring that to go through the longer process has slightly rode back from the original plans. The bishops have always argued that these prayers are not equivalent to holy matrimony in the eyes of the church, that heterosexual marriages available to straight couples, they're not the same thing, but the initial drafts did contain services which, if you squint a little bit, could look a little bit like a gay wedding. There might be rings exchanged and elements and symbols like that, that would be more akin to a wedding service, and that's now being separated out, and frankly, without a two-thirds majority existing, it's unlikely these will ever be brought in. The other critical thing that's changed and worth mentioning here is that initially the prayers of love and faith, when they were first unveiled in February, made no mention whatsoever of sex. There was no presumption that the same-sex couple coming forward would be sexually active. In fact, there was even an option for the prayers to be used for what they were calling as covenanted friendships. So these are kind of explicitly non-romantic relationships. They could also come and be blessed. However, following legal advice, the bishops have now conceded that the Church of England is keeping its doctrine on sex, and that its doctrine on sex remains unchanged, which is that sex is only appropriate between men and women who are married. And so in their document, in their kind of briefing paper for the synod, the bishops concede that it is plausible that by blessing a gay couple who presumably are having sex, the prayers of love and faith may indicate a departure from church doctrine on those grounds. However, they go on to say that because the PLF don't intend to change marriage doctrine, but instead only kind of affirm the good things that we see in same-sex relationships, they cite as examples things like faithfulness and exclusivity and stability, that the blessings can still be commended nonetheless. So what have we got on the agenda? There's all the scene setting. What have we got on the agenda today for this first discussion? Well, there's going to be a question time all set aside to questions about the prayers and the whole kind of gay blessings farrago. Lots of those questions, we can see the questions on the agenda in advance, and they're coming from both sides. There are conservatives trying to catch out the bishops into admitting that they are changing marriage doctrine by stealth. There are lots of arguments saying, let us see this legal advice that you've got, which claims that you can do these prayers without contradicting our doctrine on marriage. And the bishops keep saying, no, legal advice has always been confidential. There's lots of rows about that. But there are also some from the liberal side who are upset about there's no changed rules about whether gay vicars can get married and have sex with their partners yet. That's still kind of hanging in the ether. We're not sure which way it's going to go, and other issues. So the question time is probably going to be a bit spiky. It often is a bit a kind of chance for the different sides to air their grievances and have a pop at the hierarchy and the bishops. And then after the questions, we've got a kind of informal introductory session. So it's not a formal debate. It's where the Bishop of London, Sarah Mullally, who's been kind of spearheading the whole living in love and faith process for the Church of England, she's going to be leading a kind of presentation explaining where the bishops have landed, how they are trying to implement the February's kind of momentous vote, and why they've decided the things they've decided. And there's going to be an opportunity for some more questions after that. So we'll see how that kicks off.
The presentation before the formal debate began with the Bishop of London, Sarah Mullally, who has been leading the Living and Love and Faith, or LLF, project from the beginning, recapping what had been already voted through in February's meeting of the Synod, and reiterating just how divisive the whole process had been.
For some, what was agreed was a meteorite. For others, it was the crumbs under the table. And it may well be now that in seeking to repair the damage from what some fear was a meteorite, we are sweeping away all of the crumbs from under the table. For some, this is moving too slowly. For others, it is moving too fast.
Bishop Mullally then handed over to a series of other senior bishops to give short talks. This is actually a little unusual, and a sign of how any consensus there had been among the church's hierarchy was now fracturing. Previously, throughout the process, the House of Bishops has attempted to present a united front. But now two liberal and two conservative bishops were given the platform to make their own cases to the rest of the synod. One was the Bishop of Worcester, John Inge, who had come out last year as strongly in favour of the prayers of love and faith.
I, as a bishop, was permitted by canon law to enter into a marriage with someone who had been divorced. Many Christians, including Anglicans, would not accept that such a marriage as the one into which I entered is anything but adultery. I am so grateful that our church is more generous in making pastoral provision to allow my marriage.
Another bishop to speak next was the Bishop of Guildford, Andrew Watson. Watson is an evangelical who was one of 12 bishops to sign a letter publicly dissenting from the House of Bishops' proposals on the PLF.
It would be easy, though, for the next 48 hours to degenerate into a blame game. And I would urge all in Synod that in rightly holding bishops to account, they do so graciously. For the truth is that the motion that we passed in February has proved genuinely difficult to implement with any degree of theological and legal coherence, or at least to do so within the limited time and resources available to us. People have frequently used the images of rowing back or rowing forwards from the February motion, and I suspect that there will be plenty of references to rowing once the starting pistol is fired tomorrow afternoon. But to me, it's felt more like driving a car where there's one foot on the accelerator and the other on the brake. And those feet belong to the bishops, yes, but also to the clergy and laity here in the Synod Chamber and across the nation.
Well, we're just coming out of the Synod Chamber after that initial LLS session. As expected, the question times were a bit spiky at times, but the bishops are mostly trying to bat away attempts to kind of probe and needle and draw out more information and make them kind of give more answers. And then after that, we had the session led by the Bishop of London, Sarah Mullally, and she, you know, admitted up front that, you know, the church was just as divided now as it was in February. You know, there were conservatives who, she said, would see this motion as a catastrophe, and then there were liberals who said who would see it as little more than what she told said crumbs under the table. So she kind of conceded that these divisions haven't closed. But she kind of, again, defended what the bishops were trying to do by kind of having a big tent, inviting in lots of opinions, having what she called a rich diversity of interpretations of the Bible and of culture and of science and theology. And that practical theology, she said, was always been iterative. You know, it's always been tested, responded, in dialogue, in community. And that was how the bishops had arrived at the kind of theological underpinning of their proposals. She was also actually quite frank about the kind of constraints on the bishops. You know, she said it would have been nice if after the very lengthy living in love and faith process there had been kind of wide consensus across the Church of England, but that was clearly not the case. Without a two-thirds majority for doctrinal change, there was not that much the bishops could do, and so they were basically trying to respect the fact that there was a small majority for some kind of reform, but not enough for the sweeping changes that would see, you know, gay marriage introduced on equal terms to heterosexual marriage. And so she said, you know, uncertainty and provisionality were the order of the day. And they were trying to not change doctrine, but change the pastoral practice and the kind of implementation of doctrine to be a bit more generous, a bit more inclusive. She then kind of dwelt on a little bit on the various canons and the legal roots of how these prayers could be introduced. She said they had thought about using one route which would kind of bring in these standalone services alongside the private prayers on a temporary kind of trial basis, but had then rowed back from that because they thought it might lead to some kind of legal challenge. But since they announced that they wouldn't do it, that they've now had this big backlash, and so there's actually an amendment to the bishop's own motion by the Bishop of Oxford, who is a prominent supporter of gay marriage in church, saying let's try and find a way of doing a kind of experimental, maybe for 2 years or 5 years, having these special gay blessing services, standalone services, that could be brought in imminently, and then after a couple of years we could kind of take stock and see what we thought about it. And Sarah Mullally said herself that she was probably going to vote for that amendment, as did the Archbishop of York, the second most senior bishop in the Church of England, Stephen Cottrell. She confirmed that they were going to commend the kind of everyday prayers, the prayers that you could introduce in normal regular services for gay couples by mid-December. That doesn't technically need the synod's approval or permission, but they're obviously waiting for this synod session to finish. There was also then some interesting comments from other senior bishops who'd been involved in the process, and then there was a short time for some questions from the floor, not much more heat than light, I think, in some of these, from some of the usual figures questioning what the bishops have done. But an interesting one from one synod member who said, well, what happens if we, you know, as is planned, we start from December using the prayers of love and faith for gay couples in regular services, but we wait a few years while the standalone services kind of go through the synod. If the standalone services fail and they don't hit a two-thirds majority, which is quite likely as it currently stands, do we then stop using the everyday regular prayers, or are they going to somehow continue? Like, how is that kind of contradiction, that tension, going to be resolved? And in response to that question, Bishop Mullally said, irrespective of what happens to the standalone services, the wider kind of resource suite of prayers of love and faith will indeed be commended shortly by the bishops, and they would continue indefinitely. They don't rely on the synod passing the standalone services. So there is certainly a kind of determination to push ahead with this complicated, technical, finickety way forward the bishops have charted, despite people on both sides, frankly, being both baffled and upset by their kind of legal process they've chosen. So we'll have to see tomorrow. We come back tomorrow, Tuesday, and we pick up with the real substantive debate where the bishops have introduced a motion which kind of says, you know, we welcome the progress the bishops have made. And we'll see how synod members respond to that. There is a whole raft, 14 amendments I counted, listed of people trying to tweak this motion, both in a more conservative and in a more liberal direction. There's that critical amendment from the Bishop of Oxford, which would go back to the idea of a trial period for a few years as a kind of compromise, which several bishops have said they're going to vote for. So, yeah, we will have to see. Stay tuned.
After a no doubt slightly fitful night's sleep, the 500-odd members of the Synod returned to Church House in Westminster, just a stone's throw from the Houses of Parliament, the following day for the real debate. The rain was hammering down from dour grey skies, which seemed a bit on the nose in terms of the weather reflecting the mood in the room. Members also had to skirt past some ultra-conservative protesters on the street outside. They handed out flyers decrying what they lampooned as the Living in Free Love and Bad Faith project, which they said was, quote, putting the sin back into synod. later on, through a megaphone, you could hear their chants just about filtering up to the press room inside Church House. And one particularly memorable chant went something along the lines of, "Apostate clergy, go and join the humanists." Undeterred, the synod ground into motion for the real action of the session, the debate on a motion by the bishops which praised the progress they had made since February's vote and called on them to finish the job of implementing the prayers of love and faith. Despite the lengthy debate only 8 months ago on the substance of the PLF, many speakers on each side used the debate to re-air their now obviously irreconcilable views.
We are being walked towards a cliff edge. We know it's not really about same-sex marriage. It's instead about the authority of Scripture. It is no easy thing to stand against the tide of Western culture, with the pressures of social media and political correctness waging against the ancient, abiding text of God's word.
God is love, and he who abides in love abides in God, and God in him. There is no qualification to this verse, and I would hope that this general synod is beyond questioning whether people of the same sex are capable of loving each other. The radical inclusion, which many of us were led to believe might be the outcome of the LLF process, held out the hope of a church fully owning, embracing, and mirroring the radical love for all people exemplified by Jesus. Christianity is not about repression, hypocrisy, and denial. It is about generosity, compassion, and love.
Others, however, were more focused on the process taken to get here and the flaws they had observed in it.
When I read the LLF Synod papers, I was tempted to text the British Transport Police on 61016 because I had seen something that didn't look right. When we had the papers in February, the legal advice on the basis of which the House of Bishops brought their motion was disclosed to Synod. We were able to consider and scrutinise it, and in the light of it, have an informed debate, cast an informed vote. That the House of Bishops has declined to publish their updated advice 9 months later concerns me greatly. Publish the legal advice before you proceed. I've said it, let's see it, then it can be sorted.
This is exceedingly difficult for me. This is probably going to be one of the worst days of my life. I have suffered extreme homophobic abuse. I have been raped 3 times in my life. This, we have to resist this amendment. We must go forward in order to stop the abuse and the harm continuing. This is purely delay tactics, as was said earlier. We need to go forward in love.
We have a doctrine of marriage. It is clear. It says things like, according to the teaching of our Lord, and we cannot simply throw that out. This document attempts to restate the doctrine that we're being told is not changing, and yet proposes a pastoral step that is simply an offering at odds with that. To say that a practice is sinful is not opposed to a saviour who came to save us from sin.
So we're just leaving the chamber again after the first instalment of the big crunch debate. It's been kind of fairly as expected. Lots of angry words on all sides, conservatives outraged at what the bishops are doing, liberals frustrated with the slow pace of change. But more interestingly, there's been a whole series of amendments trying to reword parts of the bishop's motion. Some of the more meaningful ones have said, for example, that they didn't want to move forward until the bishops had published their previously confidential legal advice. This found a long sustained amount of applause from around the synod on all sides, actually, but was ultimately very narrowly defeated by the House of Bishops in a vote of the Synod at the end. There was another amendment which has been underway calling for no more progress on the prayers of love and faith until the much delayed pastoral guidance. These are the rules which would state whether gay vicars can marry their partners and be sexually active. Until these rules, which we haven't yet seen yet, whether they are brought forward. That was a bishop himself actually in proposing that amendment, and this again brought a lot of angst on the floor of the synod, lots of support from conservatives saying that, you know, this is supposed to be a package deal. We don't know whether doctrine is changing. We don't know whether we can support this or not until we know what the kind of accompanying rules are. But then a lot of liberals very frustrated that what they see as delaying tactics. That was the common accusation, that conservatives are just simply trying anything and doing anything they can to try and forestall and slow down movement towards publishing the prayers and commending them for use in parishes up and down the land. And then we ran out of time. We hit 7 o'clock and the chair wrapped us up. There's probably going to be at least 3, 4, 5 hours of more debate tomorrow morning. So we're going to come back into it all over again.
The third day dawned, and for one last time, the synod reconvened inside Church House to continue. There were more amendments, mostly from conservatives to work through, and of course, plenty more speeches.
I would love for the 60 young people in our semi-rural parish to be able to look to the Church of England and see a church who displays honesty, integrity, clarity. Their church should have confidence in its unyielding commitment to being a beacon of faith and truth in our world, with consistency between the church's professed and lived doctrines.
Apparently, as of yesterday in Parliament, we have a common sense minister. So let's have a slight injection of common sense. We've been here before, both historically and actually last February. We've already been here. We've done it. We've voted for it. Let's just crack on, guys. The doctrine of marriage is lifelong between one man and one woman for life. We get it. That's fine. But we do now remarry divorced people. I'm marrying someone who is divorced. The world doesn't implode.
The Bishop of Oxford, Stephen Croft, then proposed his amendment, which was ultimately passed, which called on the bishops to bring in these standalone services of blessings for gay couples immediately on a trial basis, without waiting for them to first spend 2 years going through the usual synodical authorisation route. Some in Synod praised this idea. Inevitably, others hated it.
Friends, let's be honest with one another. These prayers are not experimental in any real sense of the word. Without the provision of standalone services, they are a retrograde step that provides parish and cathedral clergy less freedom than they have previously enjoyed. And lest anyone be living in ignorance, let us also be transparent about the fact that numerous people, of whom I am one, have had a service of thanksgiving following a civil partnership in their own parish church with the full knowledge of their diocesan bishop for more than 10 years.
Living in love and faith can be summarized in 4 words. Did God really say? We've had years of sowing doubt about the goodness and beauty of God's pattern for marriage. We've lost confidence in the Bible and what it teaches. We've doubted whether this really was our Lord's teaching. Did God really say? Instead of proclaiming the will of God clear in Scripture, we say, what is God doing? What is the Spirit saying? This is a blasphemy against the holiness and power of God.
When it came to the vote, the amendment was passed in the House of Laity by the razor-thin margin of a single vote, 99 for and 98 against. The debate then trundled on, other amendments were all voted down, with Conservatives continuing to call for structural reforms to separate themselves within the church from Liberals, and Progressives urging no more delays and to just get on with blessing gay couples.
Like many here, I bear the cost of holding deeply held convictions while loving those with whom I disagree. As someone who holds to the received teaching of the church, I do so not because I am not listening, not because I am hateful or unthinking, but because I genuinely cannot see in Scripture a case for revision. I think it's time for formal structural provision.
It's curious, as a reformed church, that in this debate we've seen Scripture talked about more by progressives and the doctrine and teaching of the church talked about by conservatives. It's all as the Reformation has been turned round. And it's also salvation by works has now become an evangelical doctrine, which is new to me. It's curious because as an evangelical, it's my reading of Scripture that informs my doctrine. I come to the conclusion that because of the teachings of Jesus and the wider New Testament, I am persuaded of the need to revisit the praxis, to make us more biblical, not less. I choose to follow Jesus and seek a modest reform to reflect our own reading of Scripture in the light of our pastoral experience and to proclaim afresh the gospel.
So we've just finished, at last, what was an epic 8 or 9 hour debate on the prayers of love and faith. It's pretty fractious, it was irritable, at times quite angry. People actually on both sides, conservative and liberal, for and against the motion the bishops had proposed, were sounding quite wounded, quite hurt. We heard accusations of blessing sin, of risking people's salvation, of breaking canonical oaths, some strong words. There were Bible verses being flung about. There were arguments about legal advice and standing orders and procedure, about the as yet still unseen pastoral guidance, and also in particular lots of heat about what kind of structural provision might be available for conservatives. But in the end, the motion was passed, but quite narrowly in all three houses, bishops, clergy and laity, particularly narrowly among the clergy. The vote was 104 and 93 against, and among the laity it was even tighter, 104 for the motion versus 100 against. If you add up the votes across the whole synod, you're looking at about 227 in favour against 203 against. So, you know, this is a kind of Brexit-style 52-48% kind of divide, really, really quite tight. And so we also had hours of wrangling within the middle of the debate about 14 separate amendments, but in the end only one really substantive amendment was passed, which was from the Bishop of Oxford, a noted proponent of reform, pro-LGBT reform in the church. And his amendment, which passed, would start running standalone gay blessing services. So these are not where you could have a blessings, and that was the main point of the service. It wasn't part of a regular Sunday worship. So these standalone services would begin immediately as an experiment for a temporary trial period, while simultaneously the liturgies for these standalone services would be working its way through the synod during the normal 2-year roughly liturgical authorization process. This was considered by the bishops and then rejected over the summer, and then they kind of U-turned and have brought it back now after a kind of a backlash. What was unclear is after these kind of couple of years of kind of trial experimentation is finished, the full liturgical synodical process requires a 2/3 majority to sign off on it, and as I was given those numbers, clearly isn't a 2/3 majority in favour in this synod. So we may have a situation where churches can run these kind of gay blessings, which some critics have said will kind of be amount to pseudo weddings. These standalone services of blessing gay couples for a couple of years, and then the liturgies that underpin them will fail to be passed in the synod because they haven't got 2/3 majority, and then what? Do we all have to stop? We have this strange two-year window where these things happen and they stop. Really unclear what's going to happen there. So this is in some way only really postponing more sound and fury on this issue. But what we do know is that for the rest of the prayers of blessing that you can say for gay couples as part of a normal Sunday service, they're going to be formally promulgated by the bishops in a few weeks' time. And then these prayers of love and faith, as they're known, will be available for parishes which want to, up and down England, to begin officially inviting same-sex couples to come and be blessed. And that's going to begin, you know, imminently. And this, we shouldn't underestimate, this is a big deal, you know. The Bishop of London, who's leading this process, did say a few times in the debates that, let's be honest, we know that it's already possible for priests to have private sessions of pastoral prayer with a gay couple. There's nothing stopping that happening. But what is the first time is that there will be an official wording, liturgy, services written down, published with the stamp of approval from the bishops, as part of the Church of England's official approach to this issue. So this is a big deal. As I mentioned, a lot of the debate revolved around what kind of conscience protections or provisions there might be for conservatives for whom this goes too far. The bishops have promised that they will come back to the synod in February and its next meeting with as yet an undefined form of structural provision. But as you say, it's not going to arrive until February. That's months after these services have already begun, and we don't really know yet what form it will take and whether the evangelicals and traditionalists who have been calling for this will think it's robust enough and radical enough, because they have been insisting throughout this is such a big change, blessing gay couples, that they need, for their own consciences, to have clear blue water within the church between them, the Orthodox as they describe themselves, and the liberals, the revisionists, whatever language you want to use. We also heard promises that this long-awaited pastoral guidance, and these are the rules which are, we expect, will relax the restrictions on gay vicars and for the first time let them marry their own partners, which is previously to now been they've been banned from doing. There were promises from the bishops to produce this guidance as soon as possible, but they resisted any effort to give a firm deadline to that. So again, we don't know if that's going to be ready for February, the next synod. The original plan was to introduce all three elements together: the prayers of blessings, the pastoral guidance, and the structural conscience provision protections for conservatives. They were supposed to be introduced as a package, but we're not. We've got one leg of that. The prayers have gone through, and they'll begin soon, but the other two are still TBC. So in many ways, we actually remain where we were before all these hours of debates and before all this fighting, which is that this huge reform is about to begin. The Church of England is for the first time about to welcome gay couples to come and be officially blessed in church, but we don't really know, we don't have any clarity on what the long-term consequences of this will be. Will this cause a schism? Is there a way to avoid conservatives walking out en masse? You know, will this just be the thin end of the wedge and lead to, you know, full-fat gay marriage in church in the future? Or is this actually a lasting settlement that might persist? We just don't know, and time will tell.
Premier Christian Newscast. Premier Christian Newscast.
After the dust had settled and weary synod members had made their way home, I wanted to find out how the momentous 9-hour debate had landed on both sides. Was this a big victory for the progressive wing? Or do the Conservatives intend to keep on fighting given the incredibly narrow margins? Will introducing these standalone services much sooner change anything on the ground? Are we starting to see a lasting fracture within the House of Bishops? And can they ever win back enough trust from the clergy and laity to steer the PLF process to a final, lasting conclusion? I started by calling up Ed Shaw, a lay minister of an evangelical church in Bristol, and a prominent celibate same-sex attracted evangelical who's been involved in the LLF discussions from the start.
I mean, the weird thing I think this general synod has shown is that the Church of England's even more divided than we thought it was back in February, because I think the votes are tighter in both the houses of laity and clergy. But also in the House of Bishops, you've got a significant split, whereas I think, was it back in February, we had three or four bishops going against the House, when now we seem to be somewhere between 10 and 16, depending on the vote. And you said actually all three houses are divided, and the divisions are greater. The votes were tighter than they were back in February. So I'm encouraged that the Church of England is even more divided than it was in February. I think I'm not encouraged that the Church of England's in the mess that it's in, but I am encouraged that the depth and the scale of the depths of division and the scale of the opposition to these proposals is clearer than it was in February. And that's painful, but it's good news because it means we're actually going to have to come up with a solution that somehow makes something beautiful out of the mess.
And obviously, there were lots of kind of attempts through various amendments from the Conservative side to say, let's not move forward until we have this structural pastoral provision, as it's now being called. And those were defeated. But do you still feel encouraged that actually the strength of feeling has been made clear over the last year as well as the last few days, and the bishops can't kind of wave it away? They are going to have to come up with something, even if it's going to have to wait until next February's synod.
Yeah, I mean, I think early this year, so pre-February, nobody was talking about that sort of provision, apart from perhaps the Church of England, the Evangelical Council. And now bishops and archbishops are talking about it. And although no amendment calling for it got through, there was significant support for the two amendments that did call for it. And there's a commitment in GS 23-28 to do it. And some of the options laid out, I mean, not in any detail and not in sort of detail that would reassure me that they're actually serious about it. But we do seem to have moved on from saying, well, that's just not going to happen, we don't need that, to people recognising, oh, we actually are going to need something. There seems to be quite widespread recognition of that.
I remember from your speech, you spoke quite movingly about how, you know, you had kind of crumbs of comfort in February from the words of the Archbishop of York. But now you said you were walking away from the synod without any crumbs of comfort at all, perhaps forever. Do you seriously worry that the result of the debate, what we've just seen over the last few days, could force you out of the Church of England for good?
Again, I think what people don't realise, perhaps at the centre, is that some of us are leading churches which we are struggling as leaders to keep in the Church of England, because there are a lot of churches within the Church of England who are saying, how can we possibly be part of a diocese where our bishop has said that she's fully supportive of same-sex marriage, and would fit the biblical category of a false teacher? How can we stay in a church? They'll be asking me. And so there are scenarios where there will be people who are serving churches, leading churches, where their church wants to leave. And what do you do as a pastor of a church when your denomination has left you very little wiggle room and the church family you're part of want to walk away? You have to make a choice between your local church and your denomination, and that is the choice that there will be people facing that choice over the next few months. And I'm not saying that necessarily is the choice they face, but it could be. And so I feel very insecure in my place in the Church of England because my bishop is not supportive of me and my lifestyle choices, in the sense that she doesn't think they're necessary. And my local church is baffled as to why, well, many people in my local church are baffled as to why I can be part of a church that is teaching the very opposite of what I teach and the life I live day by day.
One of the other issues that was a big part of the discussions was that, again, this kind of absence of the pastoral guidance, which, you know, as many speakers noted, kind of broke the pledges that had been made in February to deliver it as a whole package. We know from kind of leaks and media reports that the pastoral guidance has actually been written, and it does relax the rules to let gay clergy enter into marriage for the first time. If that is the case, and that is the guidance that appears in next February synod, how would you personally, as you described yourself as a gay Christian, how would you feel about your church officially saying for the first time gay clergy like you are free to enter into same-sex marriages?
Well, licensed lay minister, so not gay clergy, but it would also, I think, give what it would advise in, on my situation too. I mean, I've read the pastoral guidance, all three parts. I was consulted on it. I was sent a copy. I know it exists. I've read what's being leaked, and it was one of the weird things is to sort of almost the pretense of synod that it didn't quite exist. When I've seen it, I've seen it in a well-developed form, and actually I saw it with some comments in response to massive legal questions that were asked about part three. So the reason we haven't got part three isn't because they decided there's an iterative process or whatever the language they use. I think the reason we didn't get part three was because the lawyers have said, oh, we're not sure you can do this. And also, I think they're probably right to judge that it would be a very clear, well, I think the lawyers are saying you can't do this because this will clearly show that you are changing the doctrine of the Church of England, which of course is the big thing they've been saying they aren't doing. And there'll be absolute clarity, I think, as soon as part three comes out, whenever it comes out, that the doctrine of the Church of England is being changed. And that this sort of pretense that you can, this pretense that you can make loads of changes while not changing the doctrine of the Church of England will be exposed as just a pretense. So I think that's why we haven't seen it. It's because it will be a small explosion on the whole process and everything we've been told, throughout. But it's not a change. It is a change. Part three of the pastoral guidance will show that it is a huge change.
And would you see it personally as a kind of betrayal of everything that you're trying to live out in your own life?
Well, obviously, it will be portrayed as, when I say it as a betrayal, I'll see it as a massive blow to everyone like me. And there are hundreds like me in the Church of England today, and there have been hundreds like me, or thousands like me in the Church of England down the ages, who have believed the Bible when it says marriage is a gift, believed the Bible when it says singleness is a gift, and that both have their pluses and minuses, but both are good things, and you can flourish as a human being, as a married person, as a single person. What the pastoral guidance when it comes out will do is break the link between, well, we'll redefine marriage and break the link between sex and marriage. And actually to see it less as a personal betrayal in the sense of targeting me, but more as an attack on Christian teaching that is good for everybody.
Are you surprised or even sad that there aren't any liberals who've kind of taken up the offer from the CEEC, that if they went for proper differentiation, that would actually let the liberal wing of the church go much further and get full fat gay marriage in church almost immediately, as well as keeping conservatives like you within the big tent of the C of E? There's not really been any kind of response or any interest from the other side, has there?
No, I was involved in behind the scene conversations. I spoke to at least one person who was involved in those conversations from the other side, as you could put it. They said, oh, we should have continued that conversation. I pushed them on. They've not ever publicly indicated that they're willing to do this, the substantial structural reorganisation that we talked about, which from my point of view, as somebody who at the Flora Synod in February said, I will be up for supporting the introduction of same-sex marriage, or I will not stand in the way of same-sex marriage. I do feel slightly let down because I feel that I've gone the extra mile. I upset a lot of people by saying what I said back in February, but there's been no response. And it would have been very easy for some liberals to show that they were up for conversations by either voting for Paul Robertson's amendment or the Bishop of Durham's amendment. And I don't think, or the figures would show, that not many of them did.
For a different perspective, I then spoke with Helen King, a historian and lay member of the Synod from the Oxford Diocese, who is a leading figure among those who support same-sex marriage.
To start off with, big picture, does what happened at Synod feel like a victory to you?
Victory is an odd word to use, isn't it, in any context with this Synod. It feels better than it would have done if it had lost. Is that actually making any sense at all? Because... it would have been terrible if this was lost, because we'd be going back on what happened in February. February was a clear vote in favour of moving forwards. So at least we continue to move forwards, even though we've had to go through hours and hours and hours of repeated, and I mean repeated, discussions and debates where you've heard it all before, frankly, in almost every case, and yet you have to sit through it all again. And so it was a bruising experience, not least because we'd had it all in February and we kind of thought we were moving forwards anyway.
The voting figures were slightly tighter than they were back in February. Does it feel like a handful of people are kind of rowing back on what was agreed and kind of switching sides, if you can use that language?
It's very hard to tell what was going on with those voting figures. I mean, it's very easy to go, oh, yes, you know, the amendment only went through on one vote in the House of Laity, but, you know, could have gone the other way, one vote in the House of Laity, you get what you get. There were so many different amendments, it was really hard to work out what was going on in terms of a pattern, but there was obviously a consistent group of bishops that was voting together on the conservative end of things, and a more flexible group maybe voting on the inclusive side, and the laity as ever are the ones where you just can't work out where they're going to go. And there were a lot of other issues swishing around below the surface, like the involvement of lay people, the secrecy surrounding the bishops' votes, a sort of unease that synod isn't being told enough, the concerns about the legal side of things, and all of those were coming together. So although some people would have voted in favour, whatever, some would have voted against, whatever, I think there is a sort of group, a small group of people who are concerned about something else other than this, but see the way this has been handled as a symptom of that something else.
Because there was a lot of discussion, not just of the kind of substantive theological issue at stake, but also about the process, particularly a lot of frustration about the bishops being accused of, you know, secret stitch-ups behind closed doors,
yes,
of bending the rules, of avoiding constitutional propriety, obscuring their legal advice. Do you share any of that criticism? Do you think that's fair, that attacks on kind of process?
I think there is a lot that is fair in attacking the secrecy of the House of Bishops. It doesn't help people feel confident about what's going on. On the other hand, we have now got to a point where bishops admit that they're not all voting the same way, where we can see that they're not, when they speak on in different positions on the debate. I think that's actually a lot healthier than that previous era where they all stuck together except for one accidentally pressed the wrong button. And we knew they thought differently, but on the other hand, they wouldn't admit that in public. I think it's better to have that out there, not least because it makes it clear to all of us that this is not just some maverick group in the Church of England who suddenly decided to go against centuries of tradition. This is something where throughout the church, up to the level of the bishops, people think differently as a result of reading the same texts. And that is important, that whatever your views are, there is someone in the House of Bishops on this matter who shares those views. You're not, you know, the weird one. There are different views, and they are all part of the Church of England, even up to the level of the bishops.
You mentioned some of the bishops proposing amendments. There were a couple, weren't there, from Conservative bishops who were, you know, proposing things like, no, let's pause the process until we have the pastoral guidance, or let's pause the process until we have this provision for Conservatives. Did you agree with the criticism that that's actually just they were just delaying tactics, or do you think there actually are principled objections from some of the Conservatives?
I'm not saying that there are no principled objections. Of course there are. But these three amendments to delay were, I think, all about delaying. I said that in Synod, particularly the one about from the Bishop of Sutherland and Nottingham about let's not do anything until we've seen the complete pastoral guidance. Because as Bishop Sarah has made it clear over and over again, the pastoral guidance is not going to be a document like issues that's published, you stick it on the shelf and it stays there for 30 years. It's going to be an evolving document as people's questions change, as the situation shifts, as something turns up we hadn't thought was going to turn up. It's not as if you're ever going to get a final version of the pastoral guidance. It's going to be evolving. So saying we've got to wait for the final version, this is impossible. There will be no such version.
Do you think the Bishop of Oxford's amendment, you mentioned it, the only kind of substantive amendment that really passed about calling for kind of a trial period of trying these standalone services experimentally alongside the full Canon B2 authorization process. Does that feel significant to you? Does that feel like a big change?
It feels very significant to me that we've got that, because everything we were told up to the House of Bishops on the October the 9th meeting was that we were going to have some sort of B5 commendation for standalone services on a temporary basis or something, but there would be standalone services. And so really this is where I thought we were going anyway. I was involved in the Living with Difference groups that met three times in September, and at that point no one was talking about B2 and nothing else. People were talking about this B5A method with standalone services as the thing that was going to happen.
But does it create a kind of poison pill at the end, because we know that it will run simultaneously with Canon B2, and when that eventually comes back round in probably 2 years' time, it's going to require a two-thirds vote to be passed, which on current figures is highly unlikely. And so are we going to be kind of stuck in limbo where lots of progressive parishes will have been running these standalone services for gay couples and their communities for upwards of 2 years, and then suddenly they'll have to stop because the services would have ground to a halt through Canon B2?
That's a very real possibility. I can't see how this synod is ever going to get to a two-thirds majority on this. But who knows? And it gives you 2 years in which to see what actually happens when you do these services. What is going to take place? In particular, are the Conservatives who've been talking about leaving, setting up their own church, asking or insisting on some sort of extreme structural differentiation, would they go through with that? I don't know, but at least it's clear that we are not going for the stop everything now option, because that I think would have been a disaster after over 6 years of the Living in Love and Faith process to have gone back to where we were in 2017 when Synod refused to take note of the Bishop's report, GS 2055, and then the whole thing basically went very pear-shaped, and the archbishops had to suddenly come up with a solution, which was to have 6 years, oh my goodness, of discussion. We couldn't have gone back to that again. It would have been completely ridiculous. Something has to shift, and I think the shift at the moment is remarkably small. You know, we're not talking same-sex marriage, we're talking about blessings. Actually, the standalone services would seem, in many ways, more of an appealing option to a Conservative mind, because you never have to go to one. You know, just don't go. Whereas if the prayers are used in an existing service as part of the intercessions, you know, you could be in that room and suddenly it could happen. My goodness, you know, a couple who've been together for years and have got a civil partnership suddenly come forward and the prayer is said for them. You know, what a ghastly experience. Not. I really find it hard to see why this is a problem, because no church has to do these services. No church has to use the prayers in its existing services. A vicar can decide not to do it, opt out on the grounds of conscience. It's not even opt out, because you have to opt in to do them. So if you do nothing, nothing will happen in your church.
And yet we know that the Conservatives do, despite all of that, feel unbelievably strongly about this and are pushing for this, you know, differentiation and structural reform of the Church of England. Do you have any concerns about what the bishops might bring back in February synod? They promised they would come back with something. We don't know what it looked like. Do you worry that that might undermine any of the progress that's been made?
I certainly do worry about that, because we have no idea. As you say, the bishops, particularly Bishop Sarah, who of course is on her way out of this, lucky woman, having been heading it up with extreme grace and extreme calm and great generosity for several years, she's been very clear that there will be some sort of provision made. Whether that is structural or pastoral is another matter. Pastoral indicates that if you're in a church where you really don't think you can cope with your bishop because your bishop thinks these prayers are okay, then another bishop in the diocese or in a neighbouring diocese or in the area could be the one who comes in and does confirmations at your church, for example. That's not great, but it's it's feasible, isn't it? Mm. Whereas the sorts of things people are going for, where there'll be totally separate structures. So as I keep commenting that I've read these documents from the evangelicals, and sometimes the conservative evangelicals are saying even the diocesan director of ordinance must be a different human being, because they somehow can't trust a DDO who believes in the prayers to treat a conservative potential ordinand properly. Well, that's just an insult, really, to the professional work of DDOs in our church. If you go for that level of separation, in what way is it one church? And this is where I think the calling it schism thing does come in. And in the final discussions, the final comments in the debate, there were people saying, well, this is a very Puritan view. It's about, you're suggesting we're about breaking fellowship with each other. And frankly, at that point, it does look a lot like schism.
And just lastly, then, the other kind of part of the package is the pastoral guidance, which, you know, despite leaks, is still yet properly published. How important a piece of the puzzle do you think that is? And in your view, does it absolutely have, at a bare minimum, to end the ban on gay vicars getting married?
I think that is one of the red lines of many people on the inclusive wing, that gay vicars who are in marriages should be allowed to continue in their ministry. It seems quite extraordinary when we're short of clergy to take permission to officiate away from people in this situation. So I think that really should be in there. I don't know whether the bishops will have the courage to do it. You do feel something along the way is going to be sacrificed in the interest of trying to keep everyone together. I think that would be a mistake to sacrifice these people yet again, because they've already suffered enough. And because you really do at some point have to say, no, we believe that this is right, rather than, yeah, okay, we'll say no to that because it's more convenient.
The Bishop of Lancaster, Jill Duff, is one of the few evangelicals in the House of Bishops who has from the beginning been unafraid to voice her opposition to the prayers of love and faith. At this synod, more and more of her colleagues edged out of the shadows to admit that actually they agreed with Jill.
I feel a massive sense of responsibility. That's how I feel after synods, because the margins were very narrow and there was only 37 bishops, of which only 23, I think, voted in favour overall. And, one of the key motions was on a margin of one vote. So I feel a sense of responsibility, really, because if you were doing this in a normal circumstance and you had one vote difference out of 600, you would sort of reverse out and have a think again, really. And as bishops, I think we have to find a way forward that enables us to go forward and flourish together. And that's the challenge now. When you have these knife edge votes, they're not really a great basis to make major changes.
And the numbers actually were a bit tighter this week than they were at the last debate in February, weren't they? So particularly among the bishops. So does that encourage you that you should kind of keep on fighting, that you might carry on kind of nibbling away and win more people to your side, as it were?
Yeah, I'm trying to avoid the language of kind of winners and losers, although it's, you know, that makes good journalism. So I'm with you for asking me it that way. I think you couldn't help watch the debate without seeing some of the pain in the room from different people, from Ed Shaw as he finished the debate speaking about being a gay celibate man, to some of the really moving stories of people who want to see change. And so I want to see the Church of England maintain the doctrine of marriage, which is what we're committed to doing. And I want a church where everyone flourishes, so we can kind of look outwards and reach out a mission rather than be looking at each other sort of suspiciously, because actually there's so much more that unites us than divides us. But this has been the way we are in this process is promotes division over unity. And we need to, as bishops, we need to help find a positive way forward.
Do you think it's a good idea to have a kind of experimental year or two where we're trying out this quite a new change for the Church of England, and then we could report back to synod in a couple of years and say, have we found it? Do we think we should stick with this? Should we stop doing this? A lot of people would say that sounds like a quite a sensible way forward.
It's a bit of a challenge. I did vote against it. So no, I don't, in the sense of what does it mean to take that sort of thing away? That's a really serious thing to take the idea that we're blessing same-sex couples away if you've already gone down that route. So the normal way in which we do a major change is through a more considered process that takes consultation out to all our dioceses through a process called, it's called B2, it's a legal process. And that's what's happened with women bishops. And I think out of that and women's ordination, and that's in my mind created a more stable church going forward. So the way we're doing it hasn't been used for major decisions before.
One of the other things that was really clear from the debate is that there's a huge amount of anger and mistrust among the clergy and the laity, actually from both liberal and kind of conservative groups, towards the bishops about how the bishops have been running this process. You know, we heard accusations about kind of secret stitch-ups behind closed doors and the secret legal advice that the bishops won't share with us, and accusations of a lack of integrity. You know, you're a bishop, but you're also kind of critical of where the House of Bishops have been taking this. Do you agree with the criticism?
I would love to see us be more transparent, and I voted for the amendment that would have that failed, but would it enable us to be more transparent? I think most you know, public organisations do allow minutes to be read, and I think it's interesting that there was such pressure that they were leaked. I think we can, I think there's a balance between confidential and, you know, being confidential and secrecy. But actually, I think we're airing too much on the, it looks like there's a conspiracy, actually. But when the minutes have got out, people have thought, oh, that's really interesting. It was really interesting to read those debates. That's what another journalist said. And I think one thing that was said on the floor of Synod was that it was actually really helpful to see bishops disagreeing and on really important things. And so when my colleague John Inge put forward his letter about, you know, with 44 dissenting sort of bishops saying they want to see same-sex marriage, I said, John, I'm really pleased you're doing that, because it's great to have that out in the open. Me and another 11 bishops wrote something quite different, saying that we really want to see the current teaching of the church and the discipline of the church upheld, because we see that as an important part of our, as kind of following what we think Jesus taught us to do. Other people will disagree, but at least let's be honest about that.
And we, as you said, we saw several bishops in synod proposing amendments from the kind of more anti prayers side, offering a bit more leadership maybe to conservatives in the clergy and laity. Does that encourage you that there is, you know, more of a movement that's across the church? It's not just coming from vicars and lay people, but actually there are bishops like yourself and others who agree with that theological position, who are kind of stepping out of the shadows and speaking their mind.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I was sad that Paul Butler's amendment, Bishop of Durham, he was wanting to put that on the table for real and talk about proposing firm provision. And I was really sad and a little bit surprised that was voted down, because it was voted down quite strongly by the bishops, when actually a lot of our clergy and laity are wanting, you know, they're wanting clarity. And I tried to say in my speech, I think clarity is kindness. And that helps everybody flourish.
The bishops have, well, at least the Bishop of London, who's been kind of leading this process, kind of promised to bring some form of pastoral provision for conservatives by the next synod in the springtime. Are you confident that whatever the form that takes, that it will be strong enough, robust enough to keep conservatives in the church?
I'm not going anywhere. And many conservatives, why should we go? So the challenge is exactly what that looks like going forward. And that there's headlines of that. There's some headlines if people want to look into the documents that came through on the synod papers. But actually what that looks like in practice is, yeah, you're right, has still got to be worked out. I think that needs to be worked out pretty urgently. But inevitably, there's a disagreement, I suppose, on how many people this affects. If it's just a few people, a little bit like in with the ordination of women debate, it was 7% of clergy, mostly in poor parishes. The data this time is much higher. It's some of our bigger, growing, younger parishes, really, 30 +% at least. And so that's a challenge, a different sort of provision. We can't just sort of photocopy what we've done before. We need to find a really positive way forward, I think.
There was quite a lot of references, wasn't there, to the women bishops debate and the settlement that was arrived at eventually after many years of wrangling that allowed people like yourself to join the episcopate. You know, there were things put in place for traditionalists who couldn't tolerate this. But you don't think a similar settlement could be applied to this situation? You know, maybe some flying bishops and an independent reviewer. Do you think that that's not enough?
It's hard to know at this stage. Where I am, I really benefit from those. And my colleague, Bishop Philip at North, who holds a traditionalist view, these structures enable us to really flourish. And the challenge is, can this work on a bigger scale, on a bigger theological issue? And what does that need to look like?
And you're going to keep on fighting in the House of Bishops, keep on arguing the case for a more kind of, what the phrase is really, a more robust process, a process with more transparency, more integrity.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think just more robust processes create more stability. I think you can see the sort of flip-flop of the process at the moment, even just under which canon are we commending them? It's been B5, B4, B2, you know, you need a PhD in the canon law to completely follow it, really. So I'm always impressed that journalists know what they're talking about here. But that flip-flopping doesn't create stability, especially in a wide organisation. So I want to find a good, stable way forward that helps everybody flourish.
Neil Patterson is a priest in the Diocese of Hereford, in charge of preparing candidates there who are coming forward for ordination. And he's also a leading member of Synod's Progressive Wing. Like others, he actually welcomed the increased involvement of Conservative bishops in the debate.
I know, in a way, I think it's quite healthy, because I think most of us have always known that the bishops have had a variety of opinions, and you've heard about this informally. And in a way, I think the honesty that there now is about the bishops having different views is quite good, and I think it's still true. I think I still hope this, that maybe the bishops who have different views can disagree with each other in a more civilised and constructive way than the rest of us to some degree. Because they have that high responsibility, so I hope they have the means of leading a better way through, even whilst now being honest that they do disagree with each other. You see what I mean?
Yeah. I guess the most substantive change as a result of the debate was the Bishop of Oxford's amendment, which was kind of calling for an experimental period of running the standalone services. Which in theory, if the bishops go for this, could start very, very soon in the next weeks or months when the regular prayers are commended. Do you see that as a big win? Does it change anything on the ground?
I think it will change things on the ground, and not least because I think until the bishops' meetings only a few weeks ago, that is what many people were expecting. But, you know, when we all voted in February in favour of the prayers, we assumed that these prayers would be able to be used in that sort of way. And it was quite a surprise, I think, when the papers came out a few weeks ago and suddenly this separation of the categories had been made and this steer to not use them for separate services. Because clearly that's the main occasion for which people imagine using them. You have a couple who are getting married, forming a sort of partnership, and it's the opportunity to bring that before God. And obviously people have been doing that informally for a long time, effectively making official something that's been the practice in some places for quite a long time. And so in a sense it's getting back to what people felt they had been working towards, I think. And other people opposing, of course,
I guess it speaks to the somewhat erratic nature of the process that you have. As you say, you know, the bishops were on this, were quite kind of securely behind doing a trial period. Then there was a big U-turn 3 weeks ago with the synod papers, and now they've kind of done a 180 and gone all the way back to their original plan. Doesn't really inspire confidence.
It's like the learning from the government. And there are cases of quite highly people really have different ways of interpreting the law and the canons of the Church of England. I mean, what I would always say is it seems to me there's a freedom, whilst respecting we have the canon around marriage, that doesn't rule out other things that are additional and different from, but aren't necessarily contradictory to marriage that is practiced in law. And that seems to be the space that we're stepping into quite hopefully, and which we've done many times, you know, liturgically in terms of different sorts of services that have become normal in the Church of England over the years.
I guess guess there is a lack of clarity about what might happen at the end of the kind of trial period, because simultaneously the standalone services are going to be running through the kind of synodical authorization process under Canon B2, which will require a two-thirds vote, which we seem pretty far away from in this synod. If that is voted down as we expect, are the trial services that have been already been happening for several years at this point, are they kind of left in limbo? What happens there?
Well, I guess we do wait and see. One thing I've been thinking about is, obviously, you know, wait and see what people really think, perhaps. Quite a lot of people have been saying, have been kind of keeping a bit quiet on what they actually think about the service as a whole. But certainly, you know, some of the bishops and some of the conservative letter writers, particularly some on the Anglo-Catholic side, have mostly been objecting to process. And so I'm not quite sure how solid the opposition is on synod. Because if I've had people say to me, you know, I'm not necessarily against something new happening, but I think the process is being done wrong. So if we go into the B2 process, which is the full proper process, some of them may be able to say, actually, if we do it this way, I can support it. It'll be interesting to see, I think. Clearly, some people in the debate were being absolutely clear about their reading of the Bible and what that says, and, you know, they're not going to be persuaded, I doubt, from that. But I think there's a quite a significant block who made it about the process.
One other piece of the puzzle is the pastoral guidance, which is not yet been shared. How important a kind of piece of this process do you think that is? And for you, does it absolutely have to, if it's going to have any credibility, end the ban on gay vicars getting married?
I think so, yes. And that's crucial, because we've been living with this situation with issues in human sexuality for so long, and that's become more and more unsatisfactory. And since, effectively, it was put on notice in February, you know, I'm a director of ordinands. I'm working with candidates who are in discernment. Now, I've not been working with anyone lately for whom it were a personal issue, but nonetheless, I haven't said, will you read this document, which is couched in the language of 30 years ago in quite a lot of problematic ways, and which the church has decided is going to be obsolete, and yet you still have to tell me that you'll abide by it, because I still have to take this box on this form that says you told me that. And there's no getting around that. That's clearly got to end. You know, it's becoming more and more of a sort of sham to try and maintain that. And in relation to clergy and same-sex relationships, you know, we're all over the place. In a sense, it's all about ending the pretenses, really, I think.
Hmm. Yeah, we heard kind of mention of don't ask, don't tell, and the need for more transparency, and perhaps that also applies here as well.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, one of our problems, I start to feel, is that a generation ago, the LGBT world was a world naturally of kind of don't ask, don't tell, in all sorts of parts of society, and nods and winks, and it's gone, and it's kind of preserved in the church in an impossible way that can't be carried on.
Hmm. Do you have any concerns about the provision for Conservatives that the Bishop of London kind of promised was coming, even if it wasn't ready yet? Do you think that might end up kind of undermining some of the wins?
Not entirely. I mean, I think probably more than some others on the progressive side. I want to look for some kind of structure that will help. But I've been in a lot of rooms with Conservatives, and whenever it's kind of passed back to say, what would that look like? It always looks like effectively a separate church within the church. And I've blogged about this. And if it's just about being so separate that you can say, you know, you have no part with me, well, there's almost no part that we'll have the Church of England. But at the moment, it's about saying, okay, certainly from the point of view of many Conservatives, lay Conservatives, services might happen for people you never met in a church you never go to that you don't see happen. How greatly do you need to be separated from that, really? Yeah. That's the kind of challenge I push back. If you're in a situation where, say, you know, I mean, maybe we will come to this, if you have a bishop being appointed who is himself or herself in a same-sex marriage, then that becomes a much more direct issue for people in that diocese. But actually, the current demand for separation seems to be for something very modest happening. And yet the request seems to be for this enormous kind of chasm to be opened up.
And just lastly then, do you see, in kind of big picture terms, this last year, 2023, and the prayers of love and faith as, you know, a continuing step in a journey towards a more kind of inclusive future? Or do you think we're hitting the ceiling of what is actually possible, and the bishops are now going to be so constrained by the numbers of synod and by the kind of legal advice they're getting that this limited package is as good as it's going to get?
I think we may be heading towards, I think it'll move in stops and starts. I think a part of what's got to happen now, and I think the B2 process will actually help this, is this, it's still surprising how many people, how many churches and people, in a sense, are non-aligned out across the country. And I always think the process, in spite of 6 years LLF, there are lots of churches where it's easier not to talk about it. And I think having the conversations will help. And some places that I definitely hear about is, and if you've followed the growth of inclusive evangelicals, where actually the leadership don't want it talked about because there's real diversity in the pews, as it were. And that conversation happening will help everyone, I think, and I will think it will show that the overall balance is rather different from how it appears in a synod.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess we'll have to see, yeah. There was quite a few inclusive evangelical speakers, weren't there, in the debate? So there's clearly
there were
a growing constituency.
And what they tell me that they're hearing from is people in congregations saying, thank goodness I found this space in which I can explain where I am, because I've tried to raise these questions and I'm told it's not on the agenda in our church.
Finally, I called up John Dunnett, who is the National Director of the Church of England Evangelical Council, CEEC, and a member of the House of Clergy on the Synod. Dunnett has been a pivotal figure in coordinating resistance across the church to the prayers of love and faith, and in building up a block of evangelicals on the synod to try and forestall the bishop's plans.
My first question I'm keen to know is just overall, broad terms, does that vote and that debate at synod feel like a major blow for people, like evangelicals like yourself, or is it just, you know, another skirmish in the long-running battle over these prayers?
Tim, that's a good question, and I think... the honest answer from those of us who want to hold on to a biblical understanding of sex and marriage, the honest answer is that we feel it is a watershed moment. We feel that, contrary to what the bishops repeatedly have been saying to us, this does represent a change in the church's teaching and position on sex and marriage. It does represent a culmination of debate that seems to have paid less attention to scripture and more attention to other arguments. So it does for us seem a watershed moment.
And given the Bishop of Oxford's amendment about the standalone services was passed, it seems likely that in the coming weeks and months, both the prayers and the standalone services are going to become available for Church of England parishes. So does it, I mean, if we're being blunt, that a lot of the work the Church of England Evangelical Council has been doing over the last year since the February debate seems to have failed in terms of forestalling that.
The vote to support the Bishop of Oxford's amendment was passed on a tiniest of majorities. If my memory is correct, it was something like one vote in the House of Laity. We are moving forward on a very precarious kind of basis. CEC has for some time been saying, look, we have a deep division in the Church of England. We know that there are those who want to see change. We know equally that there are many of us who feel we need to hold on to what you might call a biblical or inherited position. And part of what CEC has been doing over the last year is to try and draw attention to the reality of that division and invite the General Synod and the House of Bishops to ask the question, is there an alternative to 10 years of very damaging fight and wrangle about this? And the bad news would be, yes, from our perspective, this vote was lost in General Synod. The good news would be that I think we are now talking about differentiation or structural rearrangement. The real question of the moment for us is, will the bishops engage with us to provide the kind of provision that will enable orthodox biblical witness to be secure going forwards?
This question around provision, structural reforms of the Church of England was a major theme of the debate. Do you feel encouraged that the Bishop of London and others kind of made promises publicly that they would bring back proposals for this kind of reform at the next synod in February?
Well, clearly it was good to hear those promises made. If I'm allowed for a moment just to be a little bit cynical, we have had promises from the bishops, indeed the Archbishop of York, in the February General Synod, which don't appear to have been delivered on. So we need to see the promise delivered, not just the promise made. It's also the case that we don't as yet know what is in the mind of the Bishop of London and others about the shape of those provisions. And we are very clear that the level of provision needs to match the level of division that exists and the level of significance of these decisions.
And if what they come back with isn't robust enough, it isn't, doesn't provide that kind of clear blue water that you'd like to establish between the conservative and the liberal parts of the church, what happens then? Will people like yourself have to seriously consider whether you can remain within the Church of England?
Well, for the foreseeable future, CEC is saying to people, look, please don't leave. We know you may be very disappointed and in good conscience feel, you know, tempted to leave. Please don't leave for the moment. Stay with us and help us to get the bishops to that place where we need to be. But if you're asking me further down the track, long term, the honest truth is there may have to be a day when people like myself say, we've stayed, we've contended, we've prayed, we've engaged, we've pleaded with the bishops, but we now have come to a point where we need to consider our future. But I would want to underline, for the moment, we're not there. Please stay, please contend.
And what plans does CEEC have to help evangelicals kind of push forward on this question of differentiation, as it was sometimes called, pastoral provision? You know, I mean, I know you've written some papers in the past sketching out ideas. Is there anything else in the pipeline?
There are two immediate questions that we are being asked and for which we're going to make provision. The first is that we've got both clergy and lay people saying to us, my bishops appear now to have taken a course that's moving away from our biblical and inherited understanding on these issues. I can no longer see them as my shepherd, my spiritual overseer. Will you help find me someone who can do that for me? And one of our immediately to be pursued initiatives is to help that provision come about. That the second is that lay people in particular are saying to us, the length and breadth of the diocese, I'm not sure that in good conscience I feel able to continue to give into the finances of the diocese when my bishop and the diocese is taking a revisionist or liberal trajectory. And so we are going to be launching at the start of next week something called the Ephesian Fund, which is a national fund which will enable lay people to continue to give to their local churches and local parish churches to continue to pay their parish share to the diocese, but all in a way that enables those who are giving to be assured that it's only going to churches that are supporting a biblical or gospel position on these issues.
That seems like quite a major step. You must be kind of bracing yourself for some sharp retorts from people in the Church of England who would kind of accuse you of schism in all but name.
I imagine people will, and they already have, but the reality is here is that the schism that exists, if you want to use that word, is being created by the bishop's insistence on pursuing a trajectory that has the tiniest majority of support in General Synod that was not well presented. We were offered a pig in a poke at General Synod. We were not allowed to see the legal advice that the bishops say has supported their case. The Faith and Order Commission was not asked to produce its normal high-quality theological reflection on what's proposed. The pastoral guidance is significantly missing the sections on what will be expected of clergy and ordinands. This is not the work of CEC. This is the work of the House of Bishops that is literally driving a wedge through the middle of the Church of England. And sadly, I dare to say, it's going to do the same in every single parish church around the land.
There was a lot of anger, wasn't there? A lot of mistrust from the clergy and laity towards the bishops. But I guess a major change at the last synod was actually how a number of evangelical and conservative bishops spoke out against the plans of the majority for the first time, thinking of figures like the Bishop of Guildford and the Bishop of Sheffield, the Bishop of Sutherland and Nottingham. Does that encourage you that, unlike in February, there is a kind of fracturing of that fragile consensus among the House?
You're quite right, Tim, to point to those bishops who have felt compelled to vote against the House of Bishops. It was four in February. It was a lot more this time round. And we thank God for the faithful witness of those folks. For bishops in the House of Bishops to vote against the House, that's a big thing, a big ask. And it was enormously courageous of them to do so. We appreciate their leadership and we thank God for that.
And just lastly then, it sounds like this, as you say, the CEC is going nowhere. You know, this battle, if you can use that slightly inappropriate terminology, is still ongoing. Do you retain a hope, or even a distant hope, that the situation might be salvaged? Or does it feel like the trajectory is still the same as established in February?
Tim, perhaps it's important for listeners to understand that those, like myself, who are contending at this time for the Church of England, do so primarily because, we love the Church of England. I was born into a Leicestershire rectory. I've been ordained for 37 years. My daughter is married to a clergy person. We love the Church of England. It's who we are. And our hope remains that even if we have to structurally rearrange the Church of England, our hope remains that there will be a secure place for biblical witness, life and faith in the Church of England going forwards.
So there we are. This is really happening. By probably the start of 2024, gay couples will be offered services of blessing in Church of England parishes. Year-long evangelical fight back seems to have failed in one sense. And yet the other lesson from the synod is that the Conservatives are going nowhere. They have a major block of votes, certainly enough to prevent the Progressives from reaching a two-thirds majority, and as time goes on, they're actually being joined by more and more bishops themselves. Any sense of consensus within the senior hierarchy of the church has fallen apart on this issue, which is a big shift from when the prayers of love and faith were first proposed. And zooming even further out, many, if not most, Liberals had hoped that the Living in Love and Faith process, when it kicked off in 2017, would steer the C of E towards full equal marriage in church for gay couples. That has completely disappeared. All of the bishops and progressive advocates now accept that changing marriage doctrine in that way will be impossible for now. All that is on the table now are the blessings, which have in truth been quietly taking place in various forms in Liberal parishes for some time. But what perhaps few predicted was the extent of uproar and disquiet even this supposedly modest step would have caused among the Conservative wing. And this outrage has been exacerbated by the widespread feeling that the Liberal majority among the bishops are bending the rules and forcing through a change of doctrine by default on the narrowest of margins. Remember, one critical amendment at Synod literally passed by a single vote. The fury of Conservatives has prompted the House of Bishops to promise some kind of provision to protect their consciences as the gay blessings begin to be rolled out. But whether these reforms will go far enough to create the separation many evangelicals are demanding remains to be seen. Despite months more wrangling and another epic tussle in the Synod chamber, the future of the C of E still sits on a knife edge, just as it did after February's momentous vote. See you at the next Synod then. That's it for this week's Premier Christian Newscast. But if you've enjoyed what you heard, please do leave us a review on whatever podcast app you use. And why not also tell a friend about the show? Don't forget, you can also subscribe to the podcast to make sure you get each new episode sent automatically to your phone or tablet week by week. If you've got any questions, feedback, or want to suggest a topic we should explore, you can email me at tswyatt@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Premier Christian Newscast.